Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View. Of course, I'm Adam Lowther with Curtis McGiffin and Jim Petrosky. It's an interesting week, of course, because, you know, Kim Jong-un recently promised overwhelming response to the multilateral military exercises that the United States, Japan, and South Korea were participating in here recently. And of course, Kim Jong-un and the North Korean regime said that this was a threat to North Korea. You know, in the U.S., Japan and South Korea as part of this tightened working together that's happened, you know, after President Yoon of South Korea publicly stated that it might be time. And then we had the Washington Declaration. And, you know, we've had tighter relations because there's greater fears of North Korea. There's greater fears of China. And so now KJU's ramping up his threats. And so, of course, this week we thought we'd talk about North Korea, sort of talk about this dynamic that is now working in East Asia between the Chinese, the South Koreans, the North Koreans, the Japanese, and just get everybody's thoughts on sort of what's taking place and how serious do we take these latest threats? You know, I mean, they happen just about every single time. We have these military maneuvers. And so fortunately, we've never seen the use of a nuclear weapon yet by the North, which I think they know would be the last time they did it. So, Curtis, let me sort of turn it over to you and get your take on KJU's most recent threats of overwhelming force.
Well, thanks, Adam. I would say just a couple of quick observations. First, to your point that Kim Jong-un has not yet used his nuclear weapons, I'm going to pick a bone with you. He uses them every day, right? it's about deployment versus employment. You're right. He has not employed weapons. He uses them every day to coerce the South and the Americans. So I would say hats off that the Japanese and the South Koreans are exercising together. I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah,
that's a little sub story we're glossing over here. Look, this is nothing new. I mean, every time America and South Korea exercise, the North Koreans pitch a fit. Now when you add in the Japanese, given their history, that always freaks everybody out in the North. This sort of happens. And these threats are becoming, these grandiose threats they're just becoming so normalized that we're almost becoming insensitive to them. I don't know who that hurts more. If it hurts, us, the target of these threats, that someday we just will stop even taking them seriously, and that could be the day he actually does employ. Or is it hurt him in the fact that the more you threat, the less your threat has meaning? And so I think Kim Jong-un would probably do much better for himself to realize that his threats are probably not helping his case if the goal is to really coerce, we'll call it democratic forces, into some sort of conciliatory action towards them. So I would say, this is sort of par for the course, and pass the kimchi.
Jim, as you've, watched this, you were way back when you were a young man in the 60s or 70s.
They're still using bows and arrows in those days, right?
Yeah.
you served in South Korea, so, you know, you've got your time in Iraq. So as you know, as you've watched this evolve over the years and watched the dynamic in relationship and North Korea go from, you know, at one point was the more prosperous of the two nations to now it's the less prosperous by far. And, you know, it's got, you know, short people. It, you know, it's kind of like Munchkin Land now. And because they're, you know, so calorie deprived and, you know, you have a lot of problems as you've watched this evolve over time. And now you're watching KJU make these kinds of threats. You know, what's your perspective and take on this?
Well, Adam, since you've already, you know, sort of answered my question, and I agree with Curtis, I guess that ends the podcast. Thank you, everyone. No,
don't leave yet.
Just kidding. So this whole, this is a lot of discussion that comes out every time we do an exercise in the air. I've been in those exercises. I've heard all the complaints from the North about, this is all just a, you know, way of getting ready to invade the North. You can see how many times we've invaded the North since the treaty's been signed. It's always an excuse to maybe push the limit for KJU. And we've seen that he's done some pretty nasty stuff. We've talked about it before in a podcast, you know, bombing civilians, you know, sinking submarines, et cetera. So, you know, he does have a nasty temper side. But the fact that he has nuclear weapons causes us, of course, to take some of his shouting, even though, you know, Curtis says, well, it's sort of getting to be a norm, but you still have to take it seriously. And that's what he's looking for. You know, he's sort of like the pick me. You're forgetting about me. You're worried about Russia, Ukraine. You're worried about, you know, Israel. Pick me. What about Taiwan? Pick me. And that's what I see more as the issue, that we've got to find a way to diplomatically, if I will, stroke that side without doing anything else. However, I do, like Curtis said, think that the implications of Japan joining the South Koreans and the U.S. in exercises adds a new dynamic to this whole concept, not on an offensive standpoint, but I think more of a defensive standpoint. I think it does corner KJU a lot more than it has in the past, because he realizes he has no friends in that direction. And he's trying to win new friends, for example, with Russia. And I think that we're starting to see that come out on the diplomacy side. Now, as far as the credibility, the two things that bother me mostly about North Korea's nuclear weapons program is they are not unwilling to show everyone and demonstrate to everyone that they can be serious by setting off a nuclear weapon in an underground test. And they know, you know, it's, you know, I almost made a joke that probably wasn't good on podcast, but if you do something nasty in an elevator, everyone knows who did it, right? And especially if it's only two people. But anyway, so the point is that in that territory, if they set off a nuclear weapon in underground, everyone knows who did it. This, you know, we have very, very good capability with our, you know, satellite technology and our seismic technology. It's a difficult problem to hide. And this comment that was made by Tulsi Gabbard in saying they're probably prepared to conduct another nuclear test is a rather interesting one. Again, pick me. We're going to be noticed. And I think that's an important aspect of this that we've got to work out diplomatically. And I'm really not sure how that's done, except to say that we are serious too. We've even brought another character into the play in order to show you that. And I think that means a lot to KJU in terms of what do I do now?
You know, it's interesting because if you go back to 2001, right, and you remember George W. Bush's, you know, the Axis of Evil.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, the North Koreans at that time, you know, they didn't have nuclear weapons. And then starting in 2003, we began the six-party talks that went on, you know, that were designed to try to prevent North Korea from going nuclear.
Oops.
But I wonder if, you know, putting North Korea, Iran, and Iraq together as the Axis of Evil, and then taking one out, and then, you know, sort of surrounding the second one in Iran, right? We were in Afghanistan and Iraq, sure. So we were north and west. That the North Koreans, whom, you know, we've had a truce. I mean, think about it. We've had a truce in place with the North for what, 72 years, right? 1953 to 2025. I don't know that there's ever been a truce that lasted that long, right? Because truces have a tendency not to last very long. War resumes or a treaty is ultimately signed. And so from the perspective of the North, are you sitting there going, well, this truce has got to end? Or are you, you know, are you thinking, well, the Americans, look at what they've done to the Iraqis. Look at what they're trying to do in squeezing Iran. We're next. So therefore, we have to build nuclear weapons, which, you know, ultimately they went nuclear in 2006. And so now you're sitting there in 2025 with, you know, 100 or so. And you're saying, well, geez, I think I have enough that I can be provocative. I can threaten. I'm building a triad, you know, if this submarine, you know, goes off like planned. What is that conversation? Because this is what I really am not 100% sure of, is what is that conversation that Kim Jong-un has with himself about where he is and where he sits sort of in that dynamic? Has North Korea become sort of the master of China, because North Korea can really throw a terrible wrench in China's plans if it acts up? So I'm not sure what that dynamic and what that conversation is.
I appreciate that, because I think of it as that's the diplomatic side that is really hard to manage. How do you manage that piece? And I don't know if diplomacy works. Maybe strength works, and that's what we're pushing right now, to see where that strength goes. What do you think, Curtis?
Well, I think it really comes down to the interests of each state. I sound like a broken record, but this is what states do. They worry about their own national interests. For North Korea, their national interests are whatever Kim Jong-un determines them to be, usually his interests.
Regime survival,
right? And, you know, how am I going to, get money and maybe get influence, you know, some global influence in that regard. And for the South, it's different. I'm not sure. Let's just take, for example, reunification is in either of their national interest. I know that sounds odd. We look at the trials and tribulations of German reunification, and I'm not so sure that the South is ready to pay that bill, even if they could win that war. And, I just think it's, I'm sure emotionally they would love to reunify. I'm just talking pragmatically and practically whether or not that's really even possible. And I think Kim Jong-un is definitely he might be interested in reunifying from his own direction as a cultural
supreme leader.
Yeah, as a supreme leader. But I'm not sure he would really know how to administer the whole peninsula should he win, right? In that sort of thing. I think the bigger issue here is this new defense pact relationship with Russia, right? It was signed in June, yep. Ratified in November between the two countries, with their versions of Congress. And so they have this sort of issue now where they call it a pact. You know, you can define that as an alliance in some measure. And, you know, it involves the transfer of troops and war material in exchange, likely for, this possible transfer in technology, sensitive technology, that I think is going to advance their nuclear capabilities tenfold at a much more rapid pace. And so this is a big problem for us. And when we think about that relationship, you know, that their pact actually has language that talks about, you know, they will come to the aid of the other if they're invaded. And so this opens up another dynamic about whether or not the South and the Americans, you know, if they do were to cross the DMZ, would Russia engage, in this, under this pact? And so, again, We have to think through these things. I think we as Americans tend to want to dismiss these kinds of relationships out of hand, for whatever reason. They don't mean it. They're not, good enough. Whatever it is. But I think it's a mistake to outright dismiss these kinds of deals and these policies and these sorts of things. As I've always said, if we expect them to respect our policies, our alliances, our, if you will, threats, we have to pay a little bit of attention to theirs. And show that that chance, that respect to them. But to go to the last case on diplomacy, Jim, assuming that Dennis Rodman is retired, is President Trump going to try to come and reconnect with KJU? They had a relationship, yeah. And that relationship actually paid dividends. There were no missile tests in 2018, for example. Yeah. It was a very quiet time for the South and Japan because they weren't shooting missiles over them. Will President Trump reengage and try to rekindle this, whatever you want to call this relationship that they had? I mean, to see President Trump cross the DMZ, right, with KJU into the North and take that picture and shake hands, everybody, panned as a diplomatic coup for KJU. I'd say it was a diplomatic coup for the West in that case. And because all hell didn't break loose. The heavens didn't fall in upon North Korea when that happened. And I personally think that you look at KJU, what KJU has done for North Korea compared to his father and his grandfather, I think he's probably been the most productive. I could be wrong, but I think he's been most productive. But the last thing I have to say is you always have to remember and take into account KJU's poop bombs, right? The poop bombs or the balloons full of garbage and feces that he floats across the border, right? I mean, come on. There's nothing more coercive or damaging than that.
Well, I find that silly, but it points to what I was saying earlier, though, is pick me, whatever it takes to draw attention back to yourself. Seems to be the modus operandi that you see coming out of the North in many ways. But I want to go back to your comments about Russia and North Korea. And it's fascinating because I think of it not as a marriage of love, but a marriage of convenience. And I think their reliance on each other will only exist when they realize that they need each other. And when you get beyond that, I'm not sure how tight that alliance can be. It's so new. It's so fragile, in my opinion. And I think that gives us an ability, if we can rein in one or the other, to be able to turn things around. I also noticed.
When has an alliance not been a marriage of convenience?
Belarus and North Korea, the only two formal allies of Russia. Isn't that the case?
I think
could be.
I don't think some of the other
stands have pretty close relationships.
Yeah, they're parts of, knife. They've got, they have, multilateral organizations that the Chinese or the Russians run, but I don't think they're formal allies. But I think Belarus and North Korea are, which is, it's actually quite unusual for authoritarian regimes because authoritarian regimes have a tendency not to have, allies. And particularly, they might have bilateral agreements, right? This is what the Chinese are trying to do to everybody is they want a bilateral agreement because that's how you put the squeeze one at a time. And whereas, we have, NATO and, we had CETO and we have, all these organizations and alliances because we're not particularly interested in squeezing out of, our allies. It's kind of worked the other way around where, they've squeezed us. And now that we're, pushing back against that squeeze, people aren't happy anymore. And so, it's an interesting time to watch authoritarian regimes try to build alliances, and this would never happen, right? If if Russia were in the dire straits that it's in, right? The fact that North Korean troops are fighting in Russia and fighting in Kursk to free Russian territory, I mean, that's, and I don't know that I hear a lot of people talk about this, but this has got to be fundamentally embarrassing for Vladimir Putin.
Yeah.
That you have North Koreans there.
And I want to go back to, you know, Curtis's comment, and I sort of used it as a marriage of love and a marriage of convenience. but yes, I agree that alliances are out of convenience. However, there are long, strong ties that we have with England and with Europe that you know, are very strong and very valued with our peoples, with our governments, etc. But you didn't see that with North Korea and Russia until recently. And that's what I'm saying. And those kind of things can be fragile. And I think they just offer a niche to, you know, if you will, a wedge that can be driven in these circumstances. And going back to the article, I will say every time, sort of wrapping up at least some of my comments, I was in Korea, and every time we did an exercise, North Korea, no matter who was the leader, complained about these going-ons. And that's why this article's sort of interesting, because it's sort of more of the same. However, someday it's not going. If it continues to go, I mean, that's great. I love status quo. We're not at war. Let's stay not at war. We're not shooting nukes. Let's stay at shooting nukes at each other. We're not, you know, killing each other.
Not shooting nukes.
Yeah. Did I say we're shooting
nukes? You did.
Okay. Well. Yeah, just erase that in your minds, audience. But we're not shooting nukes at each other. And so therefore, you know, status quo is good. How long can the status quo last? And that's my bigger issue. Because remember, deterrence is convincing them not to take an action. And we can't put them in a corner where they feel obliged to take an action. And we can't leave ourselves open that they feel an opportunity to take an action. So we're balancing between those two. And the problem with North Korea, in my opinion, and I'm not a political scientist and I didn't stay at a Holiday Inn last night, like North Korea, and I would even say Iraq or Iran as well, is that those, you really don't know what's inside the mind of that leader in, you know, what's making them fear the people the most. And sometimes it doesn't work. I mean, we obviously failed to keep North Korea from developing nuclear weapons. We failed. That's a reality. With all the non-proliferation and disarmament and treaties and everything else in this world, it failed.
And why do you think we failed? Why do you think it failed? I want to say we, but why do you think it failed? Well, I mean, it wasn't for lack of technology or engineering.
Oh, yeah. So that's my specialty. So I'll turn it over to Adam. Why did it fail? Because you're right. The technology and engineering, you know, we tried to control that and it just went underground. That's and right. They built it anyway, right?
Well, so, this is the problem with when you pick the wrong war, which is what happened post 9/11, right? We picked the wrong war. And so therefore, you know, we went after the weakest of the, you know, of the
Axis of Evil.
Yeah, the tyrants that we... You know, the tyrants that we wanted to go after and, you know, the Axis of Evil. And so we picked the wrong tyrant. I mean, the great thing about, you know, the Ba'ath Party and about Saddam Hussein is Saddam was clamoring to work with the United States, right? He always wanted to work with us and always wanted to be friends, but never wanted to be a friend with him. And, you know, we fought the first Gulf War and we, you know, he only went because... You know, we said it was okay, and
more or less,
walked
that
one back. And so, the Iranians have been a fundamental adversary since 79. And, you know, North Korea has been a fundamental adversary. And, of course, because we didn't want to see, you know, Seoul shelled and the death and destruction that would have been, we sort of let, you know, had we... Could you imagine had we sent B-2s into North Korea back in, let's say, 2001 or 2003, or you pick a time before they had nukes, and started destroying through precision strikes, conventional, not nuclear, conventional precision strikes, taking out their nuclear capabilities. Do you think they would have launched an all-out war against the South? I don't think they probably would have. I think they would have come to the table to negotiate. But that, but we had no ability to truly do that because we were so heavily engaged in Afghanistan and Iraq that the, you know, the bigger problem was one that we couldn't actually devote any time to.
Yeah, I would add it even goes back into the 90s when we were engaged in the Balkans and all these other areas when they were really going, you know, when the father was going after all of that. And I was starting it anyway. And I would argue, and I'm sure, we have a tendency here to fundamentally misunderstand and devalue those who sit across the table with us in negotiation. If we don't take their issues seriously and we don't think that they can actually do the things that they're threatening to do, then we tend to sort of, you know, we do a lot of show, right? What'd you say with 6-party talks, 5-party talks?
Yeah,
I remember all of that going on years.
Yeah.
You know, of politicians saying, "Look at what we're doing to stop this." Now you can look back and go, "Look at all you did, and you didn't stop it." And so we have this challenge here of we fundamentally don't understand when nations are crying out to say, "I am so desperate to stop what you're doing, I will do this." This is what Pakistan did. Mm-hmm. And had the Israelis not identified the plant in northern Syria, we would be seeing this in Syria right now because, you know, the North Koreans are second generation proliferators, and so they are out to make money doing that. And so when you're desperate to survive, however you want to define that, you will go to great lengths, right, to ensure that you survive, and you will, as the Pakistanis said, we'll eat grass to develop their nuclear weapons. You will make friends with those you may not want to make friends with in order to secure guarantee your security. Because the opposite is signing, fundamental tertiary agreements that lack any binding, like the Budapest Memorandum, and you unnecessarily place your security and sovereignty in jeopardy, because what is in my interest today may not be in my interest 10 years from now, and so these are the challenges that I think we have a fundamental hard time understanding when we're talking about adversaries. You look at the Putin question, and everybody says or wants to make us believe that the NATO movement to the east was not the cause of Putin's behavior, yet he cites it in every speech he gives, and it is the one thing that will break any agreement in Ukraine is offering Ukraine some sort of NATO promise. So it is just intolerable. There are some things that are just, it is much better to go to war over than to tolerate that new status quo. And so we have to be sensitive to these things if we actually want to create these kinds of issues. But I want to go right back to one last thing, Adam, and that is when we talk about the DNI's threat assessment for 2025 came out here in March, and that's where some of this is coming from in the way we discuss this. But one of the things that is noted in here is about how North Korea funds its military and particularly its nuclear development. And we always think, this country's broke. It's sanctioned to the hilt. It's the most sanctioned country in the world. How does it do all of this? And the answer is theft. It has stolen so much cryptocurrency that it has, there are many articles out here now that are talking about how much it has funded the development of their nuclear weapons that hold us at risk today, that hold our West Coast at risk for sure. And this is ironic. And every time the value of cryptocurrency increases, it just makes it a more tempting target for them to steal it. So I'm very surprised that they're still getting away with this kind of stuff. But there were articles as late as this past fall documenting this kind of crypto theft. And it's mentioned here in the March DNI report. So I just wanted to throw that out there. This is how they're funding themselves.
You know, they're also the largest counterfeiter of U.S. dollars.
Oh, yeah.
Of anyone. That's one of the, and what's interesting is the first decade of the North Korean nuclear program. So from about 96 to 2006, that cost a total, over that 10-year period, it cost them $4 billion to go essentially from basically nothing to a working nuclear weapon. Mm-hmm. And so $4 billion. So over that time, if you think about the counterfeiting, you know, intellectual property theft, you know, cryptocurrency wasn't a thing yet, but, you know, they had all of these illicit criminal enterprises. That is how they get foreign currency. Because they don't really have, they're not participating in the international market and buying and selling products and getting, you know, U.S. dollars otherwise. Mm-hmm. So it's illicit. And they were able to fund largely their nuclear program through illicit activities, which they're actually very, very good at. Yes. And, you know, this is one of those sort of one of the things that most people don't understand about the North Koreans, you know, is just sort of how the regime works. And therefore, why Kim Jong-un sees no alternative, because How do you go from being criminal kingpin and the head of your own country? And for some of his people, they think he's a god. And, you know, you can literally kill anyone you want and nobody says a word. How do you go from that to, you know, what comes next? That's the problem with authoritarian regimes, is the only way you step down is, you know, when you're in a coffin. And I, you know, it's a challenge that really the only person that's ever really been able to do it was Mikhail Gorbachev.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, where did he retire to, Adam?
He came here.
He retired to the adversary. He lived in the United States.
Yeah. I mean, he came to Auburn. He, you know, I was a graduate student at Alabama, and he came to Auburn, and I went down to hear him speak, and he spoke to the basketball stadium was full of people who were there watching, you know, mm-hmm. watching him talk. And it's really, I can't think of other times that I'm sure there's got to be some other time, but I can't think of any offhand.
Yeah, I can't either. Certainly not from the Russian side. Might have been a Chinese leader a premier that somehow, you know, stepped down and didn't, you know, disappear. But yeah, it's an interesting observation. There aren't that many autocrats who actually retire. And I guess technically Gorbachev wasn't an autocrat at the very end.
Yeah, that's very true.
And so forth. So anyway, I really totally agree in that sense. And I think that one of the things that the DNI noted in this report with concerning Russia concerning North Korea was that Russia is increasingly supporting North Korea's nuclear status in exchange for Pyongyang's support to Moscow's war against Ukraine. So they're acknowledging that this relationship is going to continue to grow rather than trying to discount it and say that it is just a flash in the pan. And I think to Jim's point, it'll be interesting to see, you know, when the war is over and it's time to start cleaning up the mess, how Russia and North Korea deal with that. Although I would point out, you know, they've had a Soviet client state relationship, you know, all through the Cold War. And I think we just recently, Adam, didn't we just recently find out, was it just recently put out that the Korean War, that some of those jets were flown by Russian pilots? And so they weren't necessarily Chinese like we thought they were, and we don't know this until the 2000s.
Wow.
Yeah. That we're actually that, you know, our fighter pilots flying their Sabre jets into Mig Alley shooting at Russians. So it's Yeah, there's a relationship
volunteers.
There.
Volunteers.
I'm sure they were volunteers. Yeah. I'm absolutely sure. I'm sure the Germans didn't know they were shooting at Americans in the Battle of Britain, and or with Claire Chennault flying tigers, right? And the Japanese didn't know that. So, any case, this is pretty standard. The last thing I'd like to throw out here in a minute or two we have left is that the DNI notes this idea of adversarial collaboration. We've talked about this, I think, in a podcast or two. In the past, but they really come out and they include that this I'm going to quote here from the report, cooperation among China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea has been growing more rapidly in recent years, reinforcing threats from each of them individually while posing new challenges to U.S. strength and power globally. And it's the idea here that this alignment is continuing, that it is solidifying, and this all bodes tough when you look at that alliance. Three of the four are nuclear powers, possibly four of four. So that's a big deal, and we need to think about that, especially considering that the United States is the only country in the free world with an intercontinental ballistic missile fleet and a strategic bomber fleet.
I wonder here, I wonder if one of the reasons that President Trump, he's largely said that the reason that he wants to negotiate a truce or, hopefully a treaty that ends the war in Ukraine is he's repeatedly said, and I've listened to him, that he wants the killing to stop. He seems to care a lot about the loss of life. But I wonder if, he also or, his staff are looking at the very variables that we're talking about, where the Russians are out helping others with nuclear programs in a way that they were not before, because the Russians have been sort of skeptical of the North Koreans. And if you reach that, cessation of hostilities with Ukraine and it's a truce or it's a treaty, either way, does Russia then sort of pull back? And I wonder if that's part of the calculation for trying to push forward and into the war in Ukraine and to end the need for North Korean support or Iranian support or, Chinese support. And then therefore all that nuclear materials remember the Russians are the ones who have all of the special nuclear material that is needed to make pits by the North Koreans, the Chinese, And so therefore
Iranians.
Maybe that's part of the calculation. I don't know for sure, but it would certainly be a good outcome.
Well, I would say this. It appears to me that the Russians are not concerned about proliferation in the same way the Americans are. Okay. Right. So if they were, they would be stopping Iran. They're not. If they were, they would interject into North Korea. They're not. So who's next, right? Will Belarus be next, or others? So clearly the Russians are not interested in non-proliferation, at least not in the way they used to, and with states that they're friendly with. The other thing I would say here is that do we think that when the Ukraine war is over, no matter who the victor is, that all of a sudden Russia is going to get back in line, it's going to follow the rules-based international order and stop trying to be a malign actor?
I don't know.
I would say no. I don't know, at least not as long as President Putin is in office. I just don't see how that happens unless it's part of the negotiation to bring them back. But if that happens, then what happens to China? Does China then become isolated? I think that is there's talk about a new triangulation where they want to drag them away from Chinese influence. But I don't know that means that you can bring. How do you bring back Russia led by Vladimir Putin, who the West has called a war criminal? Are we just going to forget and forgive all of that? Is he going to pay restitution?
As long as you say my bad, then I think
is that what it is?
I think you're okay.
Mulligan, I want a mulligan, please.
Yeah. So Well, of course, great conversation, gents. It was good to get together to have this. Of course, we want to remind you, the listeners, to check us out. You know, don't forget Deterrence Down Under, Real Space Strategy, Global Security Review. Check out the articles there. You know, there's a Peter Husey events, you know, every couple of weeks. So make sure, and there's some great ones coming. Of course, thanks for listening. And as always, we want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to The NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.